What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, everybody. This is going to be part two of our episodes on the backpack murderer, Ivan Milat. And whew, it's a lot. If you haven't listened to part one, go listen to that because I'm not going to like recap or anything. We're just going to jump right in and you will probably be very confused. And even if you're not confused, you'll be like, who cares? Because I don't know what this guy did. So
yeah, lots of vital information in that first episode.
Yes. So go listen to episode 300, part one. And with that, let's get into part two. So we are in November 1993, and seven victims have been found murdered in the Bolongalo State Forest in New South Wales, Australia. Joanne Walters, Caroline Clark, Deborah Everest, James Gibson, Simone Schmidl, Gabor Neubauer, and Anja Habshid had all been hitchhiking and backpacking before they disappeared between the years of 1989 and 1992. All seven of the victims were found buried in various areas of the Bolongalo State Forest. They were all found in shallow graves, and they were all found between September 1992 and November 1993. While the manner of death varied across the victims, with some of them being similar, but there being multiple manners of death, including blunt force trauma, being beaten, being shot, being stabbed, and some of the victims were strangled as well. The task force that was put together to look into these murders, called Task Force AIR, believed that there was a serial killer operating in the area. Police put a victim profile out to the public and tips were flooding in. There was also a $500,000 reward out there, so that probably helped.
Yeah.
But so far, nothing had really panned out. But on November 13th, 1993, just 9 days after the final victim was discovered, a tip would come in that changed the course of the investigation. Now, interestingly, this tip came in November, but not too much was done about it until April of the next year. Now, to be fair, tons and tons of tips were coming in, and it was this tip with other things that kind of helped put everything together. So more had to happen, but
it takes time to substantiate these claims. You know, they can't just run off and investigate every single thing that comes through there, because that would
especially
be
when
insanity.
Thousands of tips are coming in.
Yeah. I mean, no, they would never sleep.
But this tip was from 24-year-old Paul Onions. He contacted police in Australia about an encounter that he had had years earlier when backpacking in the country, and he believed that the man that he encountered could be the killer that they were looking for.
Interesting.
So Paul Onions is a British Navy veteran, and in 1990, he decided to quit his job as an air conditioning mechanic engineer to explore Australia. So he left England, went to Australia, and he initially stayed in a hostel in Sydney, but he set out to backpack around the country. And his plan was to go east to find work picking fruit because, like, he quit his job. So he probably has some savings, but he pretty much had nothing.
Yeah.
And because he was on a very limited income, you know, savings amount.
Budget,
Yeah, budget. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. On January 25th, 1990, Paul Onions was hitchhiking along the Hume Highway, which, if that name sounds familiar, it's because in part one, we talked about how Joanne and Caroline were last seen asking for directions along that same highway.
Right.
And also to put this encounter into perspective, like timeline-wise, this was just 3 weeks after Deborah and James were killed in December 1989. This was January 1990. And then the next known attack that Millett did was January 1991, a whole year later.
Wow, that's crazy. And he was a truck driver, correct?
Yes.
So he would frequent that area.
Yes. So Paul was making his way from Liverpool East towards Mildura when a man who identified himself as Bill picked him up. Paul noticed that this man was buff and had a long mustache. The man was asking Paul a lot of questions about his travels and his life, but like very specific questions like, how long have you been here? How long are you planning to be here? What are you doing here? Does anybody know where you're going? Like, you know.
Fishing.
Yeah. And Paul tried to like play it off and be like, this is just friendly conversation. You know, like he's driving me. We're just talking. And the man gave a little bit of information about himself. He told Paul, again, that his name was Bill. He said he worked on the roads, that he was from a Yugoslavian family, and that he was divorced and living near Liverpool.
Okay.
But about an hour into the drive, things started to get awkward. Paul would later tell Australia 60 Minutes, quote, he became a bit anti-racial to the immigrants who were living in Australia. I was so happy to get the ride, and then all of a sudden, I thought, oh no, first go, I got the nutter. Yeah, which is just so British.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
So funny. But yeah, so he was kind of like very uncomfortable with the stuff that quote unquote Bill was trying or was starting to say.
Right.
And eventually they made it just south of Mittagong, which is a town in the Southwest Highlands of New South Wales. And this is less than a kilometer or half a mile away from the Bolongolo State Forest.
Oh,
and this is when Bill's demeanor really started to change. Bill, and I'm going to say Bill, but quote unquote Bill, this is clearly not a man named Bill, but he began varying his speed and looking in the rearview mirror often. And then suddenly he pulled over to the side of the road and said he was going to get some cassette tapes from the trunk to play because they were losing radio service. But Paul thought this was weird because he knew and saw that there was an entire tray full of cassettes in the front between the two seats.
Yeah.
So he was confused and he got out of the car as well. And Bill told him to get back in the car in kind of a menacing tone. And Paul was like, whoa, I'm just like stretching my legs, chill out. And Bill kind of insisted. So Paul listened. But as soon as they got back in the car, Bill pulled out a gun and pointed it at Paul's head.
Oh my God.
He told Paul that this was a robbery and he pulled out some rope in an attempt to tie Paul up. And Paul hesitated and almost complied, thinking, okay, it's just a robbery. I'll give him what he wants and then he'll let me go. But something in him said no, so he opened the door and started running.
Hell yeah.
Thankfully, he was able to get away, but as he was fleeing, Bill was yelling, stop or else I'll shoot, and actually did fire one shot that thankfully did not hit Paul, but he did fire at him.
That's terrifying. I can never imagine, like, running and like having your
someone's
back
shooting at
to
you
somebody like how, what do you do, like are you like bobbing and weaving, like
I don't
run
know
as fast as you can straight ahead, like that is terrifying,
so scary. And at one point, so they're running down the whole highway, at one point Bill actually tackled Paul and they were literally wrestling in the middle of this busy highway.
God.
But Paul was able to get away once again, and he stepped in front of the next car that drove past him. And he basically had later said he'd rather die being hit by a car than whatever this man was going to do to him.
Yeah.
So he stepped in front of a car, and thankfully that driver, a woman named Joanne Barry, slowed down. And Paul kind of got into the car and she was kind of freaked out because not only did she have her sister in the car, but also their five children in the car.
Holy shit.
So of course she was kind of freaked out, but Paul was saying he's got a gun, go. So she kind of started to drive away, and then she saw the look of terror on his face and she was like, okay, he's fine, he clearly is the safer one here. So she immediately turned the car around and started driving away. And she did get a glimpse of the man that had been chasing Paul and saw him running back to his car carrying something. Joanne drove Paul to the Mittagong police station, but they were closed. So they drove to the next town over, Bowral, I think is how you say it. And when they got there, Paul explained what had just happened. He described his attacker. He also told police that his backpack had been left in the van because he just like hopped out and ran. Yeah. So he told them what his backpack looked like. He told them that inside was a camera, some clothes, and his Sony Walkman. And then Joanne also corroborated this account, the man's description from what she saw and everything that, you know, she could recall. But unfortunately, because they didn't have the man's license plate or even a last name, the police were kind of like, you know, we'll file this report, but it's unlikely that we'll catch this man.
That's so frustrating when you have two witnesses who saw the perpetrator and they're like, sorry, like, we'll do our best.
I know. But I mean, it kind of makes sense. It's the middle of a highway. Like, it's not like this person lives in town. Yeah. So thankfully, Paul was safe, but he had zero money. So thanks to the help of the police and a generous civilian, he was able to make his way back to Sydney to replace his passport. And once he was there, he actually continued backpacking through Australia. He was like, I'm going to stay here and keep doing stuff. So I was like, okay. But he was safe. His life continued on, but his attacker was never caught. And, you know, he did think about this at times, but there wasn't much he could do about it. So he kind of moved on.
Yeah.
In 1993, over 3 years, almost 4 years later, he started hearing about these bodies being found in the Bolongalo State Forest near where he had been attacked. And he knew that he had to call the police in Australia.
Good.
Now, Joanne Barry, the driver who picked Paul up, actually also called police on November 9th to tell them about what had happened. Yeah. And then when Paul Onions called and told police about this, they started to look into this further. Now, like I said, it took some time to get to this report. You know, like all these tips are coming in, they're writing them all down, and it took some time. But by April of the next year, they finally realized that this was a credible lead and could very well be the killer. Now, investigators in the serial killer case realized that there had been no like full investigation into what happened to Paul after his report. And the only thing official that they were able to find was what the officer who took the report wrote in his notebook. Like, they couldn't even find this official report filed.
Damn. That's sad, because that just means they didn't really take him, like take them seriously. Yeah.
And like, even if they did take him seriously, they just were thinking, well, nothing's going to happen from it. Whatever. Like, I mean,
no one's
going
to get murdered. It's fine. Like, this guy's never going to do this again. He's just having a bad day.
Totally. I mean, and maybe they did file a report and got lost. Like, there's other possibilities too. But yeah, they found that there wasn't much. So they actually flew Paul Onions back out to Australia to see if he could identify any of the suspects through a photo lineup.
Okay, that's a good start.
Yeah. Now, remember how in part one, I said that there were 32 people who they considered suspects?
Yes, they narrowed it down from like thousands to 32. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of those people was Ivan Milat. So as we talked about in part one, Ivan and his brothers were well known to police all throughout their childhood and even into adulthood. They continued getting in trouble, and Ivan himself had multiple convictions for burglary and theft. And he had also been acquitted on a kidnapping and rape charge in 1971, but that was still a part of his record.
Yeah.
So he was on police's radar as a potential suspect, and they had actually already been looking into him further by the time they got to Paul Onion's report or tip. On February 26, 1994, police began surveillance of Ivan Milat's home, along with the homes of his brothers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They were able to build a timeline of the abductions and murders, and they were looking into Malat and his brother, a couple of his brothers, and they were able to determine that Ivan Malat himself had not worked on any of the days that they believed the abductions and murders took place.
Okay. Not looking good for him.
No. They spoke with acquaintances of Malat's who told them about his obsession with weapons that existed since childhood and followed him into adulthood. They also learned that shortly after Joanne and Caroline's bodies were found in 1992, Malat sold his silver Nissan Patrol that he had driven for years. There was also another report pointing to Ivan Malat. A backpacker from Australia named Mary called the tip line to report that a man matching Malat's description had attempted to abduct her and a friend in Bowral in 1977. So Mary described her abductor as a man with black, straggly hair, and they brought her in for a photo lineup, and while she wasn't 100% sure, she picked out Malat.
Wow.
Malat fit the profile of the killer that police had put together. He was known to travel around the area where the murders happened, and he had a criminal history.
Lots of red flags.
Lots. And so when they brought Paul Onions out, they flew him out on May 2nd, and they did a photo lineup of several suspects, one of them being Ivan Malat. And on May 5th, Paul identified Malat as Bill, the man who had pulled a gun on him and attempted to rob and likely kidnap and murder him 4 years earlier.
Oh my goodness.
Now, at this point, they didn't have any evidence to definitively link Malat to the actual murders, but they did now have evidence linking him to Paul Onion's attack. At 6:36 a.m. on May 22nd, 1994, 50 police officers surrounded Ivan Malat's house, armed with shotguns and covered in bulletproof vests. Now, they had a lot of intel on him. They knew that he had this obsession with weapons, and they had been watching him and knew that, you know, this existed in his house. And he was also known to protect himself ferociously. So that's why they created this whole, like, SWAT team to prepare.
Right.
And actually, instead of swarming into the home, they decided that they were going to basically call him with a negotiator to try to coax him out of the house. Because they were afraid that if they raided the home, he would escape and be on the run.
Mm-hmm.
So Detective Chief Superintendent Wayne Gordon, who was at the time the lead police negotiator, called Ivan Malat's phone number once all the police officers were in place surrounding his house. When Malat answered the phone, he tried to pretend that it wasn't him. Like, he tried to be like, no, this isn't Ivan Malat, but Gordon knew his voice.
Oh, yeah.
Gordon would later say that Malat was, quote, very alert and challenging on the phone. He was confident and cocky. He wanted to be in charge. I think he was trying to hide things in the house during that time. There were two separate phone calls that had to take place, and Malat was kind of joking around, but finally he agreed to come out of the house. He exited the home with his girlfriend and was immediately arrested.
Oh, shit.
Now, the charges he was arrested on at this point were robbery and weapons charges related to Paul Onion's attack.
Right.
And one officer recalled that he seemed unfazed about the fact that he had just been arrested. But this arrest on the Paul Onion's charges allowed police to search Malat's home. And in that search, they found a lot. But it actually wasn't all found right away. So like I said, they were aware that Malat had this arsenal of weapons. But when they first entered his home, they only found one hunting knife and a part of a gun, like a replacement part. Nothing else. But as they started searching more and more, they figured out where everything was.
Oh.
Now, two of Malat's brothers had been interviewed prior to this raid as part of the investigation, because like I said, they were suspects too, but they were cleared when their employment records showed that they were at work when the murders took place. But because they had been interviewed, Ivan was aware that the investigation was getting closer to him. So he hid everything in the cavities in walls in his home and behind insulation in the ceilings.
Wow.
And this was well concealed. At first, when they opened up the ceiling, they didn't find anything, but then they pulled back the insulation, and that's when they found the mother load.
Oh my gosh.
In these cavities in the walls and ceiling, as well as in bags and boots throughout the house, they found lots and lots of weapons. This included rifles, shotguns, crossbows, knives, and tons of ammunition. And they found weapons that matched those that they knew were used in the murders. Two 22 caliber guns and a Bowie knife. Later, the Ruger 22 rifle found at Malat's home would be matched with ballistics analysis to several of the fired casings and bullets found at multiple crime scenes. They also found a lot of other evidence. They found a postcard written to Ivan that he said was his, but it was addressed, "Hi, Bill." So after he confirmed this was like a postcard written to him, they asked if he also like went by Bill.
Yeah.
And he was like, "Oh, no. That wasn't for me. That must have been a mistake." But it's police like, bro, knew this wasn't.
Yeah. You already admitted that it was for you. And we already know that you're Bill.
Yeah, you use that name.
Jig is up. Yeah.
And then they found items belonging to several of the victims.
No. I mean, good, but...
I know. So in both Ivan's house and the homes of his mom and several of his brothers, police found clothing, camping gear, sleeping bags, and more belonging to the victims. So specifically in these searches, police found Simone Schmidl's blue sleeping bag and tent, along with a headband identical to the one found on her body, Simone's German brand portable stove and other mountain sports equipment, Simone's water bottle that was marked with her nickname, Simi, Gabor's Indonesian currency because him and Anja had recently visited Indonesia.
Right.
Paul Onion's blue denim shirt that was in his bag left in the car when he fled. And Caroline Clark's camera. And then in his brother William's home, police found a photo of Ivan Milat carrying Deborah Everest's sleeping bag. This photo was dated March 29th, 1991. Deborah and James disappeared in January 1990.
Oh my goodness.
So Ivan Milat was taken into custody and questioned, but during the entire interview, he remained uncooperative. He wasn't answering questions with straight answers, beating around the bush, and just didn't give anything up.
I wonder if his family, like, unknowingly was using these people's things, do you think that they, like... Not.
I don't know. I mean, it's definitely a possibility, but... I don't know. I don't think so. I honestly think he just stored stuff there.
Okay. I was just like, oh, finding their clothes.
Yeah. No, and this is just my speculation, but I would guess that he probably started storing the stuff there shortly before he was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. It was all in his home, and then he moved it because he would later try to shift blame onto his family members.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that. So years later, Bob Godin, who was the detective that was the lead investigator on the case, recalled that when he was taking blood and hair samples from Milat after his arrest, a cold shiver went through his body. Godin said, quote, "I looked up And there's Ivan looking at me with those cold, sadistic eyes and a smirk on his face.
Ew. Of course he had a smirk on his face.
Right? And he probably is sitting there thinking like, oh, they're not going to find all the stuff in my house. Like, of course they're going to find it. Like, it's not like you hit it that well.
You're smart, but you're not that smart. Exactly.
Yeah. Two of Ivan's brothers, Wally and Alex, were also arrested on firearms charges for what was found in their home. And investigators were hopeful that they would either turn on Ivan or, like, blame him for the evidence found in their home so that they could basically get more evidence against Ivan. But his brothers never, like, turned on him at all.
Which is not surprising because they're all criminals. And,
yeah,
I mean, in a lot of cases, criminals don't typically flip unless they really have something to gain. And there would really be nothing for them to gain.
Yeah. It's not like they were being charged with, like, the murders or anything like that.
Right. I wonder if they knew. Like, do you think they had any insight to what he was doing?
I don't know. And that's something a lot of people question. Is if they knew. I don't think they knew the extent of what he was doing.
Okay.
So the day after his arrest, Ivan Milat appeared in court for the robbery and weapons charges, and he did not enter a plea and was remanded to custody. Or, you know, was to remain in custody. He didn't get bail at that point.
Yeah.
On May 31st, 1994, 9 days after Milat's arrest, he was officially charged with 7 counts of murder.
Wow.
He continued to maintain his innocence despite the massive amount of evidence found in his home, which he claimed he had never seen before and that it wasn't his.
Okay. It's just in my walls. Like, oops, I don't know what happened. Magic. Like,
dude. Ridiculous. A month later, Milat dismissed the family lawyer, James Marsden, the same man who got him acquitted on that kidnapping and rape charge in 1971.
Wow.
And this is because Marsden had advised Milat to plead guilty
mm-hmm.
because of everything that was found.
Yeah.
But instead of listening to his advice, Milat dismissed him and basically tried to fundraise for a better defender, but he ended up being represented by a public defender.
Okay.
Milat's committal hearing was about a month and a half long, spanning from October 24th to December 12th, 1994. Over 200 witnesses testified during the hearing, and the evidence was found to be enough to go to trial. So he was remanded to custody and would remain in jail until his trial eventually began almost 2 full years after his initial arrest. On March 26, 1996, Ivan Milat's trial at the Supreme Court of New South Wales commenced. He was charged with 7 counts of murder for the deaths of Deborah, James, Caroline, Joanne, Simone, Anja, and Gabor, and 1 count each of attempted murder, false imprisonment, and robbery in relation to Paul Onions. And he pleaded not guilty.
Jeez, dude.
So now, of course, there was a huge amount of evidence against him, the victim's belongings found in his home, the weapons that matched those in the used in the murders, the photo of him with Deborah's sleeping bag, but he continued to maintain that he was innocent. Milat would later talk with ABC in Australia, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, for coverage of him on Australian Story. And in that, he explained his defense, saying, quote, my basic defense in my trial was that it wasn't me. I don't know who did it. It was up to them to prove my guilt, not for me to prove my innocence, which is technically true. The burden is on the prosecution. You're innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah.
So his lawyer argued that there was no non-circumstantial proof that linked Milat to the murders. So even the ballistics matching, that was circumstantial because they weren't able to match it to any of the bullets found that, like, killed the victims. It was just spent casings at the crime scenes.
I was afraid of that. It was going to be, like, circumstantial.
Yeah, technically, right. It is all circumstantial.
So DNA, there's blood. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of the evidence was found at multiple of the Milat homes. So they tried to pin the murders on his brothers, specifically on his brother Richard.
Damn.
Richard was actually tried in relation to weapons, drugs, and stolen items found on his property during the search. So this gave the defense the ability to connect him to the evidence found and try to pin it on him. Despite Malat's defense trying to pin the murders on his family members, several members of his family testified in his defense and provided alibis for him for the days that the murders took place.
Shit.
False alibis, because we know now he did it, but Malat even took the stand in his own defense, during which he denied everything. The cross-examination of him was pretty intense. It was ruthless, with prosecutor Mark Tedeschi not letting him make up excuses. From Ivan Milat, The Last Ride, quote, he faltered after Tedeschi reminded him that the gun parts that he said were put in his home by someone else were painted in camouflage colors in the same fashion as his other hunting equipment. Tedeschi had pointed out that it was an amazing coincidence, considering that Milat had already admitted that the paints used were in fact his. So the prosecution laid out all of the evidence and discussed that while, yes, it was mostly technically circumstantial, it was very clear that it linked him to the murders.
Yeah.
There was a lot of evidence found at his home, and the fact that it was clearly hidden made it even more damning. 145 witnesses testified for the prosecution, including Paul Onions, who discussed his attack by Ivan Milat. Milat's trial lasted 18 weeks, and the jury deliberated for 3 days. On July 27th, 1996, Ivan Milat was found guilty on all counts.
Wow.
For each of the 7 counts of murder, Milat was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. For the counts of attempted murder, robbery, and false imprisonment of Paul Onions, he was sentenced to 6 years each.
Hmm.
When he was found guilty, Milat only said, I'm not guilty of it. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Yeah. Ivan Milat was sent to Maitland Gaol, which is also known as Maitland Correctional Center in East Maitland, New South Wales. And on his first day there, he was beaten by another inmate.
Oh, wow. Wasted no time.
No, truly. On May 16th, 1997, after almost a year in prison, Milat attempted to escape. So convicted drug dealer George Savis and Milat planned an escape, but their plan ended up failing, obviously. And Savis was actually found dead in his cell after taking his own life.
Oh, shit.
After this attempted escape, Milat was transferred to Goulburn Correctional Center, where he would be imprisoned in the maximum security unit. Of course, Milat appealed his convictions.
Of course.
In November 1997, he filed an appeal claiming a breach of his common law right to legal representation, claiming that he was not given proper legal aid. But the Court of Appeals dismissed this.
It's like, bruh, you fired your
lawyer and then hired a new one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, sorry you had a public defender, but like, that's your bad.
Yeah. In 2004, Milat filed an application with the High Court of Australia to be granted special leave to appeal on new grounds. But the court also dismissed this application and upheld the Court of Appeals' decision to deny his appeal.
Excellent.
He appealed in 2005, twice in 2006, and in 2011, but each appeal was denied, and he remained in prison. Milat also attempted to harm himself on several occasions while incarcerated. In 2001, he swallowed razor blades, staples, and other metal objects. In 2009, he cut off his own finger with a plastic knife. This time, with the intent of mailing it to the High Court of Australia to force an appeal. Why he decided this is beyond me, and why he thought this would work is beyond me. But obviously it did not work.
Yeah, this idiot. Like, send it back to him.
In 2011, he went on a 9-day hunger strike in an attempt to be given a PlayStation. He lost 25 Ooh. Kilograms or 50 pounds during this hunger strike, but he was denied. He didn't get his PlayStation. In June 2005, Milat's former lawyer, James Marsden, made a deathbed statement claiming that Milat had been assisted by his sister, Shirley, in the murders of Joanne and Caroline. This has never been proven, and Shirley has never been connected by authorities, but it is interesting that Marsden would claim that on his deathbed, because, like, what does he have to gain from that? Nothing.
No. Unless he just wants to, like, stir the pot up a little bit. I mean, yeah,
that's definitely a possibility. Or if he has, like, a grudge against Shirley for some reason, like, who knows? But
yeah,
but she's never been officially connected, so just putting that out there.
Yeah.
In 2015, Boris Milat, Ivan's brother, claimed that Ivan had admitted to shooting that taxi driver in 1962 when he was 17 years old. Yeah. So I briefly mentioned this in part one, but Neville Knight, the driver, was robbed and shot in the back that left him paralyzed from the waist down.
So sad.
Another man named Alan Dillon was ultimately arrested for that crime and served 5 years in prison, but Boris is sure that Ivan was the one who did it. So in 2015, Boris spoke with Stephen Apperin, a former homicide detective who worked on the Milat case, and he claimed Milat's involvement, and Apperin actually administered polygraph tests on both Boris and Alan Dillon, after which Apperin was convinced that Milat was the one who was guilty of the robbery and shooting.
I mean, it fits.
It fits. And Dillon has never officially been cleared by authorities, and, you know, authorities have never charged or definitively connected Milat, but they have acknowledged the similarities because of the fact that Milat paralyzed several of his victims before murdering them.
Yeah, it's very true.
Now, Boris Milat is the only Milat family member to publicly denounce his brother. In 2019, he told 60 Minutes, quote, "He was dead to me a long time ago. This man is just an evil serial killer right to the last bone of him." In May 2019, Ivan Milat was diagnosed with terminal esophageal cancer. In August of that year, he was moved to a secure treatment unit of the Prince Wales Hospital to receive treatment for his progressing disease, but he eventually ended up denying treatment. As it was clear that Ivan Milat's life was nearing the end, New South Wales police officers decided to visit him to see if they could garner a confession. And they actually visited him 8 times, and they were hopeful that he would confess, because he had still never confessed to what he had done.
Yeah.
Of course, this did not work. From a statement from the police department, quote, "Various strategies were deployed on each occasion, including different combinations of detectives and utilizing recorded interviews with victims' families as an investigative technique. No further information was received or provided to police during the interactions." It is believed that Milat confessed to his mother that he was the backpack murderer. Now, in that 2004 interview on Australian Story, Milat denied that his family was involved or knew about the murders at all. This was interesting to people because he, at his trial, used the defense that his brothers were the guilty ones. Yeah. Yet now he's saying, no, they weren't involved. They didn't know anything.
I guess he's like, well, that didn't work, so I might as well just
go the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
So there are reports that on her deathbed, Margaret Milat said that while Ivan never officially confessed to her, he did tell her that he was responsible for the murders. It is believed that this is true, but it's never been officially confirmed, and he never officially confessed to authorities. At 4:07 a.m. on October 27th, 2019, 74-year-old Ivan Milat died due to complications of his disease. Prior to his death, Millett had written to his family requesting that the New South Wales government funded his funeral.
Okay.
This, of course, was denied, and instead his body was cremated and his prison funds paid for his cremation. There was no deathbed confession as some had hoped, despite police's efforts to get him to admit to anything before he died.
Of course not. I mean, they rarely do.
No. But this was especially pressing because police believe that Millett was involved in many more crimes than he was convicted of.
Yeah, so do we.
A list of 58 unsolved death and disappearance cases were reviewed by Task Force AIR for Millett's potential involvement. And many people believe that he could be involved in several of these. But that is what we are going to discuss in part three. Because I want to fully share those victim stories. Yeah. I don't want to like cut it short. I want to go in depth on all of these because several of these there's been a lot said about them and a lot discussed about Millett's potential involvement. And so I really want to like go in depth. So that's why I'm going to make it a part three so that we can talk about them, focus on those potential victims and the known victims, because right. This part was very heavily focused on like Millett, his arrest, his trial, all of that.
Right.
So I want to give some time to the victims as well. But before we end today's episode, when Millett died, two of his brothers spoke out saying that they believed he was innocent. Bill and Richard Millett, which if you remember, Richard is the one who Ivan specifically tried to say did it.
Yeah, he tried to pin it all on him.
Yeah. They both said that Millett was a good guy and that they did not believe he was guilty.
Good guy. That's very... No.
No.
Despite... Even if he didn't do these heinous acts, he still did a lot of other shitty things. And he blamed...
That he was convicted of.
Your brother for the murder. So...
Yeah.
Okay, where he's a good guy.
No. Speaking with Nine News in 2019, Richard said, quote, "I don't think anything of the police force. I don't think you can trust them."
That has nothing to do with anything.
No.
Like, good try.
Now, Maureen, who was Wally Millett's former wife, also spoke out against Ivan. And she's another one that spoke out against him, but she's not technically like immediate family. So yeah. That's why it's said that like Boris is the only one who's spoken out against him of his family. Mm-hmm. But Maureen is one of the ones that Ivan had an affair with.
Oh.
Maureen had an affair with Ivan while she was married to Wally for over a year before they broke things off. While she regrets that part of her life, she says that she believes Millett was not innocent. She said, "I just don't want to think that he could be capable of doing something like that. But I believe that he did it. He's not innocent." After his death, she said, quote, "To me, he died 20-odd years ago. And when he was arrested for this, I have no feelings whatsoever. He's just a person that's died. I'd rather remember him as the person I knew, a nice person." So, like, can you imagine like what she,
a little
the
bit.
Feelings that she had of, like, she only knew him as, like, a nice, you know, by her account, a nice guy. And now she's finding out that he did all of this.
Yeah, and likely maybe even, like, during their time.
Mm-hmm.
Together. So, I mean, she definitely has conflicting emotions, which she probably is experiencing conflicting emotions, because if she was with him for over a year, chances are she was probably in love with him. And, you know, just the whole, it's very convoluted.
It is. And she probably honestly like shut down once she found out what he did and tried to just like remember who she knew him as. And so it makes sense that when he died, it didn't even phase her because she's like, he died to me a long time ago.
Yeah. Wow.
So part three will be out later this week. We'll discuss all of the potential crimes that Milat has been linked to. Like I said, there's 58 that Task Force Air reviewed. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they've never been able to fully link him to any of them, and he never confessed to any other crimes. No, at all. And that's kind of why they worked so hard. Of course, they wanted him to confess to the murders he was convicted of as well, because, like, even though he was convicted, that still gives you another, like, step of closure for the victims' families. But they were also hopeful he might confess to some other crimes, but he never did.
Yeah.
So we will discuss several of those. We'll also discuss Milat's great nephew, who was convicted for murder. So,
dang.
Yeah, this family, there was a lot. Oof. A lot of not so great stuff. But stay tuned for part three. It'll be out later this week. And until then, keep it human.
Bye, guys.